everyone, and welcome back to the VFX Existential Crisis podcast. It's early in the morning. It's hard to get that out. So it's been a while since we've recorded. We wanted to chat today about all the sort of hype that's been out there about, YouTube versus Hollywood and who's winning and all that kind of stuff. Specifically, I guess, framed by Obsession. What's the other one called?
The Backrooms
against The Mandalorian, as if it's some average serial contest, which weirdly it tends to be. But in the meantime, we haven't recorded in a while. So we wanted to just catch up and sort of check in on our journeys, our existential, VF existential journeys. I'll start with mine. I had an interesting week last week. I have successfully distracted myself by doing a one-to-one scale backyard set extension, i.e. shed renovation. It has been more complicated than I expected. It's over budget and behind schedule. But I did get it back to my main. Well, I finished it yesterday. I still have lots of wrap-up stuff. The backyard is a disaster. But one thing I took out of that was that worked for me in many, many ways. But it might have been just a little too big by myself. So it got to a point where there's some moments last week where I was like, oh, my God, this is never ending. So it made me appreciate working in a team environment more, because doing it solo was quite challenging. And even like my daughter came to Home Depot with me one day, and that made a humongous difference. Like just having someone else to go like, I don't know, which screw should I buy? You know, that kind of thing. So I do think that is something, if you're, you know, not employed, it's again, a reminder to reach out to people, because that human connection, even if it's through remote kind of stuff, is a big deal. Otherwise, you know, you sort of get in your own head. The other thing is that sort of darkened that was I started to pay attention to like, oh, I should probably find work that doesn't cost money. Well, I'm saving money is what I'm telling my wife and myself, but so kind of getting back into, oh, I need to find a job was kind of a little bit like, ugh, this again. And then on top of that, I checked off a bucket list thing and I saw Napalm Death, which I had not seen before. And I was listening to Napalm Death all week, which was cool, but at some point it was like, okay, this is too dark. I'm getting too dark. So I kind of had to switch to like some other like light dance music to sort of like chill out. So that was kind of my existential journey this week. How about you?
Yeah, this, you know, the weeks are rarely in one direction. There's usually ups and downs and troughs and valleys and peaks and all those kinds of things. Last week was generally pretty good. The I got rid of one client who was making my life miserable, which was emotionally gratifying and financially devastating, if you will. I also had the good fortune of landing a really awesome client, Rebel Fleet in New Zealand, who I'm working with. They are a really DIT specialist, and they do a lot of work in New Zealand and Australia. And they've got this cool technology called Console that I'm helping them bring to North America. So that's kind of exciting, and it's in our ballpark, our wheelhouse, obviously.
Yeah,
that's cool. Our underwatched, but an underappreciated episode last time about financial management prompted a conversation between my wife and I about, you know, where we're really at with things. And, you know, it's one of those conversations that we don't mind kicking down the road because it's awkward and, you know, we did it. And it actually, things are not as struggly as we thought they were actually in the long run. We just got to be a little bit mindful and, you know, we're not making the megabucks we once were. And it's fine. Actually looking at it and confronting it and creating a plan around it, like Chris talked about last week, was actually put us at ease a little bit. So, yeah. It was a stressful hour and a half of spreadsheet negotiation, whatnot. I'm fortunate that I have a really awesome friggin' partner who's, you know, got her head on securely. And, you know, she's always had the teaching job, the sort of secure profession. And I've been the wild card where it's been sort of up and down. So we accept the ups and we accept the downs and we kind of roll with it. So yeah, by and large, pretty good week.
I'm glad to hear that. That's, I think people, like my wife is the type of person who is like really like focused on her finances, especially like the day-to-day stuff. But if you talk, you want to talk about like the macro stuff, that's where it's kind of like, I don't want to, it's too much, too overwhelming. And surprisingly, when you talk to people, in the industry, even producers, which I kind of find surprising, production people in general, who are used to trying to look at a big problem and organize it, they don't usually have a great handle on it. And I think it's that emotional anxiety. It's the same thing, I think, that I've seen with conflict. Like there's a minor conflict, major conflict, and nobody wants to address it. So they get into this kind of weird, you know, like anxiety about, oh, I don't want to do it. And then they kind of like dismiss it and it just makes it worse, like way worse.
Yeah. Delaying a problem almost never.
Yeah.
There have been instances in my life where what seemed like a pretty significant problem went away for some reason, you know, but that's very rare. The waiting it out. The risk though is that like it's a ticking time bomb and like it doesn't go away and it amplifies and gets bigger. And then you're dealing with a much bigger problem.
And anyone who's gone and faced the problem, if you ask them after, like you were just saying, oh, I feel way better about it. You know, it's over, it's addressed, it's not over, but it's...
That's actually a really good leadership point and something I emphasize with all of my teams. It's like, you always hear, oh, you know, my student has bad leadership, blah, blah, blah. Some of that's on the staff too. And I say not always. I mean, sometimes individuals can be terrible leaders, but like leaders can only make good decisions if they're getting good information. So like if you're sitting on a crisis.
Oh yeah.
I think everyone's entitled to sort of try and wrangle a crisis on their own, particularly if it's one of their own manufacturer, fine. But like if in 24 hours you have not addressed the crisis correctly, you need to escalate that to your supervisor or up the chain. And it can be very scary, but like if you have the right boss, the attitude should be, now you've got two people dealing with this problem and you're carrying half the load. Also, as a manager, particularly a studio manager, I have way more resources that I can deploy than a producer on a show, for example. So if you need crew, if you need render, if you need me to talk to a client, all those things can happen and make your life easier. But if you bury it and don't tell anybody, and I get a call from the client because now it's become a real problem, then sort of all bets are off, because then, you
know, this is my career. Most of my career is fixing that problem. Yeah. Like someone didn't talk to the client honestly, talk to the studio honestly. Maybe they were optimistic. This happens where you get like in the weeds, and they call it, I think it's the planning fallacy. Like everybody sits around the table and goes, this is impossible, but let's try. And then, you know, so there is that, but that is like a big part of my career has been fixing those problems. I've been burned by that, like pretty bad, like personally, by people under me, not telling me the truth.
Yeah.
And like in a really, really negative way, and only finding out when it was a problem.
And then you look like a schmuck because you haven't got your finger on the pulse.
It's cost me money. Let's put it that way. And, you know, that's, and then you learn as a leader, you learn from that to not quite, this might be something interesting for people. Like the reason I don't trust you completely is because someone has not told me the truth in the past. It's like, if you ever talk to a cop who's been a cop for a long time,
people.
I mean, my dad's a volunteer cop and his friends are cops. They're very suspicious people. And, you know, and at the time when I got burned pretty badly by that, I was kind of like thinking everyone was like me, who was like really confident in their voice and all that kind of stuff. And I've been in
situations. We're deviating somewhat from what we're going to talk about, but actually, this stuff is gold. And one thing that I've noticed as we transition into work from home is that you'll lose a lot of information. Like, you know, I could be in the studio and I could see someone walk out of dailies in a huff, and I could say, "Oh, what's going on? Why are you in a huff? Oh, you know, they just gave me notes on this shot that, you know, I've been working on for 3 weeks, and it's a composer. I'm like, oh, 3 week comp. Like, let's have a look at what you're, you know, dealing with." Or the supervisor's a jerk or whatever. And you have this information that gives you an opportunity to respond and like evaluate. But work from home, you don't get any of that incidental human contact. So you actually have to pry. You have to be like, hey, how's it going? What's going on? What are you working on? How are things going?
I think that's the thing that a lot of people made mistakes on, is they assume they could just carry on the same way. Whereas,
sure, no, 100%. Yeah.
Like there's a thing that people have both loved and hated this approach since I've gone remote. And it's like, I want dailies with everyone in them. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, this is a waste of my time. I can blah, blah, blah. Well, most of you just sit there with your cameras off anyways and do your own thing. But it gives everyone it sort of creates that opportunity where everybody sees how everyone's feeling. And yeah. And then I encourage the smaller groups like departments to do the same thing. And so in some ways you have to kind of like, you have to work harder at it. It's not, you're not going to get incidentally, you have to kind of create the opportunities for it to happen.
100%.
But yeah, you're not going to catch, but then you're also not going to catch the initial stray. So there's like pros and cons. Like I come out, I'm pissed off because something's happened to me, which happens to me all the time. It's much better if I turn my camera off, walk upstairs and walk back, than having everyone in the whole studio see me fucking lose my mind. Yeah. I don't know. There's pros and cons.
Yeah. I just think that like,
but yes, I
you have to acknowledge as a leader that you're losing a lot of incidental information you would otherwise get in a group, like on-site environment.
It creates a formality. That's the big thing. So when I used to work at Rocket in particular, I would call it the don't let Chris go home time. Because everyone at the end of their day would come to me and say, here's my problem, here's my thing. And I'm like, okay, guys, I also have to go home and I got work to do. But that's part of the job. I didn't get that remotely, you know, and because I got it sometimes, but only maybe more serious. But I also had to work to try to force it. So I would try to have meetings with my core team more often, you know? So whereas maybe I don't even think I ever did a core team meeting in person, because you're seeing each other all the time. But in a remote setting, you've got to do it like every day or every other day or something like that. But anyways, so we are, we're all adjusting. I mean, I have to say, one of the things that really kind of bummed me out last week is I went and met some different people to see what's going on in the industry in Toronto. And I have to say, there's not much. But the commute to get there was like, oh, my God. It was.
And you're already in Toronto. So like, it's an intra-city commute.
This is crosstown. You would get there faster than me, I think, from Oakville.
That's crazy. Yes. Actually, what you're saying is interesting, because, you know, I'm reaching out to individuals to connect them with some of my clients and do some networking. And I'm surprised by how many people have taken an early retirement or are still looking for their next gig. Like, it's still pretty pervasive. Like, these are very senior people that, you know, should otherwise have work in most circumstances. And yeah, it's still a little disheartening to see that there's many, many, many talented people still scrambling for that next thing. So,
yeah, it's a bit busier in Montreal again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously taken a massive hit from its peak. Vancouver's reasonably busy, but none of them are busting out. They're just sort of right normal busy again. And Toronto, I think, has, I don't know if it's shooting as much. Like, I don't have any data to back this up, but the apocryphally and anecdotally, it's like, yeah, there's not as much going on. Or it's like
a third, apparently, of what a normal year would be this year.
Well, that's not good. And then on top of that, because the budgets are down, then, you know, for VFX, that's a different thing. which kind of leads as a good segue into the next thing we wanted to talk about, which is what's been driving me crazy lately is now that I've done a little bit of AI type stuff, I see AI stuff everywhere, you know? And so, interestingly, our thumbnails we talked about, like I saw another podcast and it clearly is using ChatGPT as well.
Because they got the same pink and blue.
Because ChatGPT has this, no, it's a different color scheme, but there's some weird stylistic similarities. Like just this, the rendering style, the rendering style, the like the weird use of post-it notes and weird mugs. Like I don't know.
There's some sort of logic that's sort of there that you can help recognize in different spots.
It's like the robot really likes that. And yeah, it's strange. But on top of that though is articles. So there have been so many articles about Hollywood is screwed and Mandalorian lost obsession and back rooms. And I've never understood this. I know it's a thing where people like think a box office is a competition. Like, I guess it is on one level, but
it is,
but it's weird.
Right? Like, but like, I mean, this used to drive the industry. Like, every one of the studios trying to outcompete the other studios for box office. Like, that was in the true capitalist sense, in the purest form of the world, like, who could make the better movie that had more audience appeal, that made more money? And somehow we got away from that, it seems. And now we're back, I guess. So we're looking at margins and profitability and box office.
I think it's like easy AI article fodder too. I think that's part of the hype as well. Like, you can tell the style.
I think you're looking at it in a very binary way. It's like, it's either YouTube or it's Hollywood. And I think the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. It's like Hollywood is this exploitative machine. I think it is. It is looking for the next thing. We know superheroes have run their course. It's been 20 years of superheroes. They don't know what to do next. And now they've got these hits in YouTube. So I say, dear viewer, get ready for 15 years of YouTube knockoff movies, because this is the new farmland for IP for sure. They're going to start looking at all of the YouTube comment to find the next back rooms or the next obsession.
But so let's sort of paint the picture here in case you don't know anything about it. So Mandalorian and Grogu, which I saw when I loved the movie, it was great. I'm sure I'll watch it at least two more times in different platforms. We made the and practice what we preach kind of thing. And we went, and my son and I got the D box seats and spent the most possible amount of money you can going to a theater. We both really enjoyed it. I just think that franchise in particular captures the sort of cowboy essence of Star Wars better than anything. It is a little bit less new. I think that's one of the downsides of the TV-ification of these things, like the episodic. It's more about the bulk of the work, not necessarily the specialness of the show. And so it was an interesting attempt from them to sort of switch that model and go towards a movie. It was not like a normal Star Wars movie in many ways. Like, it didn't try to do like the scroll. It didn't try to, it kept to be a Mandalorian style show, which I appreciated, music, all that kind of stuff. So that was quite cool. And then I guess these, which I did not see, Obsessions, which I think is that kind of a horror movie?
The horror movie. Yeah.
Horror movie. Okay. Well, that's a whole different topic.
Yeah.
And then Backrooms, which I don't know anything about, but I that it was a YouTube series
phenomenon. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of, they turned into a film. And the sort of narrative is that they did about the same amount of box office or one beat the other or whatever it is. But the cost was drastically different. Now this is one of the, like, I'm actually annoyed with the binary nature of the conversation. I don't understand why, for example, they're totally different genres of movies.
Yep.
So if it was like the Star Wars version of YouTube versus Mandalorian, I'd say, okay, that maybe is an interesting comment. But like, do I want to see a horror movie or Baby Yoda? Those are two very drastically different things. Mm-hmm. And I still don't really get the whole thing, especially in a fractured media landscape. Like, there's no massive market share TV. There's no massive market share movies. There's just no massive market share anything. Everything's so fractured. So getting any kind of traction at all should be a win. Now, I don't know what Disney set its targets for. Maybe they're disappointed. I don't know. They still made hundreds of millions of dollars.
I think there's a lot going on here. I think I haven't seen the movie, but I can say from a business standpoint, I mean, clearly 3 or 4 years too late, right? Like, it didn't capitalize on the TV show. It also, if you think of the potential box office as your total addressable market, you know, they had cut their total addressable market essentially down to people who watch the Disney Plus show, The Mandalorian, at some point. Yeah. Yes, you could do the homework if you really were determined, or you could see this movie in isolation, but they didn't do themselves any favors by kind of creating that barrier, for sure.
One thing I will say, they did make the movie accessible. You didn't need to know any of the backstory at all.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure, obviously, that would be intentional.
I was kind of surprised.
From an outside perspective, someone might expect, I haven't watched that show. I don't have a Disney Plus subscription. I'm going to give this one a pass, right?
Fair enough.
And just at a pure business level, that seems to be part of the mistake. And then there's also sort of the Kathleen Kennedy legacy. And like, there is a segment of the population, for better or for worse, a segment of the fan base who have largely written off Star Wars because they felt that it drifted too far from what they perceived as their core values. And I think the discussion about YouTube beating Star Wars, a bit of a victory lap for those individuals who are like often YouTubers and like trying to tout their own, social media pull, let's say. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think this is not the end of Hollywood by any stretch. These people are marketing geniuses. If you consider even AI, like the difference between a Disney and an individual contributor who can make a movie, you know, it's the marketing outreach and, you know, the mark of success and imprimatur that you get being a Disney release or a Sony release. That's the differentiator between, you know, AI Bob making his movies and putting them on LinkedIn and saying he's a filmmaker and, you know, something really substantial. So
I think the back end of this too, like people will continue to see Mandalorian and Grogu I don't know, like horror movies and these things, like maybe they'll create a franchise out of it.
But by the same token, I have some notes, so I'm
sure
not fucking out of my ass here. Backrooms opened to 81 million domestic and 118 million worldwide. And Obsession crossed 100 million in its third weekend. It actually went up 10% in its third weekend. So this is where the word of mouth is actually helping these things. And the budgets were tiny. Like Obsession had a budget of about $1 million. They're saying 750 to a million with a $148 million box office. Like that kind of return on investment, I mean, it's crazy. The Mandalorian budget, for interest's sake, was $165 million. So obviously it needs to make, you know, that probably doesn't include marketing, by the way.
Yeah.
And keep in mind that whatever box office any of these movies gets cut in half for the exhibitor. So, it's pretty interesting to see these home runs and Backrooms, which is one that I'm more familiar with even than Obsession. A $10 million budget with $118 million and climbing return on investment. That one came out from A24, which is pretty... You know, it's one of the better production houses these days for finding kind of niche content. So it's cool to see that happen.
Yeah. So I'd say it's really good news if you are a filmmaker. I think it's a bit overblown, the news too, which I'll get into in a sec. But it's not great if you're in big budget visual effects movies.
Nope. That's true.
I mean,
another kick in the teeth, but.
Yeah. And so like you can see the sort of the big tentpole thing is now a tiny million other things, and I can see it everywhere. Like, yeah. You know, I was working on ads. They last, you do them in 6 weeks. They last for a week or a month at most, because everyone's on, all the gaming companies are on a subscription model. So they have to churn out stuff every month. Now TV is on the same model. It's like subscriber model. You got to like keep something in your face, and movies are not. So they're kind of like sort of becoming either they're really spectacularly successful. And like, I just read today that some jerks and are like scalping tickets for the Odyssey, which is bizarre. I don't know if it's a true story or not, but you get these like big things, but they can't predict them anymore. And this is what I was going to get to in a second. It's like Mandalorian and Grogu. You can say, okay, it's definitely not as successful as like maybe could have been like 5 years ago or whatever, but it's pretty much a guarantee amount of return. Whereas those other two shows were total speculative hits.
Yeah. But
so except for the fact
there's two factors that play into that though. The first factor is the risk is minimized because like Backrooms had a 300 million views or something ridiculous. So like there is a built-in audience, and horror has a built-in audience. So like it's not an accident that both of these are horror movies. I think
it's a decent bet for
it's a decent bet. Thing. And also the risk for these companies at $1 million is really small.
Yeah.
And the payoff is really big. And so, you know, I think Blumhouse and A24, you know, they do these movies for $1 million and maybe they make $1.5 million, or maybe they don't even make their million. They don't need to have hits every single time if every sixth film is 100 times return on investment, right?
This is what I'm getting at. This is where I think the comparison is bizarre. Because having worked in the music industry and having worked on a lot of those level of movies in Toronto, it's not been the market that it was in the last 5 years the whole time. You know, I've got lots of horror movies on my resume, and they are, you know, they churn. I worked for these guys who like just churned out movies, like an insane amount of movies, actually. And because they just, and it's the same in the music business, you can go, all right, I'll give a cheap contract to this person, this person, this person. There's just a boom hit, win.
Yeah. You know? It's a volume game.
It's a volume game. Yes. Yeah. So there's that. And the other thing is horror through all of this has specifically done well.
Yeah.
Like consistently people will go out for the experience of seeing a scary movie in a group. That's a given.
And the Blair Witch is sort of the definitive made for 40 grand, made $400 million
exactly. Globally. So it's not like this hasn't happened before. And then to sort of like count a YouTube person as the underdog is weird to me, because YouTube is now most of TV, most of not just TV, like most of media watching. So they're, I would say, are they bigger than Disney at this point? Not quite, but close.
YouTube is, I would think so.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think what's interesting is like, it used to be, I feel, more competitive. I feel like Hollywood was trying to compete with social media. They viewed it as a drag, which it was, because the eyeballs were migrating from movie theater screens and TV screens onto phone screens. But I think now, I feel like the logic is changing, and now Hollywood's trying to co-opt social media and piggyback off of it. So. You know, I understand that, you know, during the last round of strike negotiations, ACTRA was, you know, trying to expand its reach. So they were looking at unionizing some YouTubers and getting them on board. And that would be like a new line of revenue for them and a new,
segment to sell to, right? That's where the new...
That's the frontier.
Yeah.
And now we've got, you know, these companies that with vast amounts of wealth, and they're borrowing YouTube ideas, and then you know the next thing they're now going to do is vertical drama, which we'll talk about in a minute. Where like people have created these 60 to 90 second clips that are serialized. People watch them. It's targeted generally at 45 to 60 year old women. They watch these little super dramatized, like over dramatized
soap opera
piece of content, soap operas essentially. And if they want, they can buy that outfit or they can buy that couch. This ecosystem exists in China in a big way, and in Asia more broadly. And now we'll likely come here. Well, you know, Disney is not stupid. Netflix is not stupid. They're now looking at, you know, commoditizing Netflix of vertical production. So it won't be very long before your subscription includes a TikTok-like algorithm, which gives you Netflix content. And
so this is where I think it's interesting, because the just in the job market, there's way more jobs in lower paying jobs from what I can see in advertising, and people trying to crack this nut. Just basically, like, if you appreciate art, the artistic side of film and television, there is, I'd say 90% of the industry doesn't give a shit about that. It's about commoditizing, making money, product placement. It always has been there. But the amount of it is insane at this point, because you can embed things, you can, you know, redub, you can you know, you could change my, you know, just watching sports, like, you realize that none of the things on the screen are actually there in the physical space. They're all essentially like a visual effect designed for advertising. So these kind of micro dramas and things like that, they need, this is the problem with this kind of thing. You need the money to make them. It's the problem with any YouTube creator. It's like, there's an entrepreneurial start to building that stuff, but at some point you're going to run out of money or energy to do it. And so you need to have somebody. So the easiest way to do that, and it's built into YouTube and all these things, is to make ad money. Like, we're trying to do it. If we get a certain amount of subscribers, subscribe right now, please. And a certain amount of hours, you can start to monetize what you're doing, but you're not going to make tons of money on that unless you get really big.
Well, speaking of money, the current vertical drama market is valued at about $5 billion. That's 2025, and is forecast to grow to $15 billion by 2033. So, increasingly people are taking this seriously. I mean, shooting, what is it? 9x16, you know, is literally offensive to me, but that's okay. I'm not the target market, right?
I just cut a music video for someone, a friend of mine. It's not like a big deal or anything, but they shot everything vertical, and it wasn't with any real purpose. It was just, it's just how they shoot, because that's how your phone looks. I think more and more that will be what people are used to.
You know, they're saying that the budgets for some of these run between 100 and 300K. So it's like, you know, if you're one of these more serious productions, you know, that's a legit budget. Mm-hmm. I think you could do it guerrilla style to a point, and then you're filming in the forest and whatever, you know, like a lot of new filmmakers do.
Yeah.
But, you know, the view is, as this market takes off, you know, there could be opportunities for visual effects to participate in some of these. You know, sci-fi is a very popular genre, and, you know, is it going to be more After Effects-y than Houdini-y? Yeah, probably. But, you know, competition drives viewership. And if this continues to be a trend, you know, maybe that's a new avenue to look at.
I guess the question is, in that $15 billion market, is it five dominant shows, or is it like literally a million shows?
Yeah.
Because the problem that... You know, what does every successful YouTuber do once they get to the peak? They make a TV show or a movie.
They get an agent. They go to Hollywood. Yeah, exactly.
Or they start a talk show on linear TV. And I think that's partly money, but it's also partly like legitimacy, like a prestige
thing. Yeah. I think it's the difference between self-publishing and publishing. Like, anybody could write a book and put a PDF on the internet and call themselves an author, but like having a publishing house edit and validate and approve, it's like a mark of success, a mark of quality. And so when those people who have built their YouTube empires, I don't know, strangely, I guess they want more validation that they're not just a fly-by-night, so they do these sort of more traditional media roles.
Well, they're looked down on. Hey, they shouldn't be.
Yeah, they shouldn't be. And I think increasingly that's going to
that'll change.
I think that has been a legacy, and this has been Hollywood, like, you know, putting them at arm's length. Like, yes, you guys are in a corner because you're making trash. But now they see that there's money in that trash, and therefore they're like scavenging like little raccoons.
There's still something there, though, and maybe it'll after a generation it will come out. Because even sports, so like the MLS, which I follow, in soccer in North America, it's moved to Apple TV, and a big cut. And then even Canada Soccer moved to One Soccer, and a big cut on it is that it's not on regular TV. So it's not, it can't be that important. And so like those MLS in particular is banking on essentially a younger market to pick up soccer. So they're basically looking at, you know, we would be the younger people in this category where it's like, well, you know, if you're not on TV, you're not legit. So they're hoping.
I think that's also a little bit of an old school view. Like,
that's what I mean.
TV is legit, and streaming is not. Like, there's big bucks on sports, and one of the reasons why the streamers want it is because it's like you need to be there between 7 and 10 to watch the baseball game,
right.
And they just feed you ads just like cable used to do.
But I don't. So it's interesting that like you cannot watch. Well, you can't really watch MLS on TV. You can sometimes. They have made, after their first or second year, they made more opportunities for the local markets to carry the shows. But it was an extremely bold move where it's like, we don't care. We're going on Apple TV. And then...
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I just think that's like part of a shift in sports, though. Like, remember when Hockey Night in Canada used to be on the CBC, right? Like, for our whole lives. And then basically... It just became too. The rights became so valuable that CBC couldn't afford it. They couldn't justify the expense of what are essentially taxpayer dollars to carry hockey when TSN.
But the knock on it is, it's the same knock on what I was saying before is, okay, agreed. TV is not necessarily where it's at, but you lose that sort of monocultural kind of event. Kind of thing.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And you get, so people just don't, if it's not pushing, like if you're not interested in soccer at all, you won't see MLS soccer appear in your feed unless you're a really avid Apple TV watcher. It's the same with Formula One.
But that, so, yeah, I feel like that's such a phenomenon of our culture though. Like,
I know.
That's, you know, when we grew up, we had like whatever, 5 channels. I don't know, yes, we're dating ourselves, but like, you know, everyone watched the series finale of MASH. Everyone watched the series finale of Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Everyone watched the finale for Friends because these were cultural phenomena. And now, you know, there's so many channels, there's so many shows, there's so many bands. It's like finding commonality is way more challenging right now. You don't get those cultural touch points very often anymore.
Well, what's feeding it is your algorithm. So someone who's making money off you is telling you what your community is or what's cool. Now, it used to be some network executive and whatever, and a bit of buzz. And so it's interesting to me, like, you can see, like, established brands like Star Wars struggling. And I don't know if they could have done anything to not be in the situation there are now, because they could have made the best movie of all time. They could have made the worst movie of all time. And I don't think it would matter. It would matter a little bit. It would be like a little bump, because the longevity of any success or failure is, it's so throwaway now, because you immediately need to move on to the next thing. And it's always been like that in episodic television, right? Especially, actually, in some ways, it was more like that, where you had 22 episodes and it was more like you got it and viewership mattered.
Yeah.
It's the same rhythm, but the target is lower and wider. So, you know, you make a... So, like, I've... In the last year, I made, you know, commercials that got 2 million views in, like, a day.
Yeah.
In a day. And, but then
we're still waiting for our 2 million here.
I'd love to hit 500. It would be nice. Yeah, but 2 million in a day, and then literally in a week, forgotten. Because the release is done, it's all tied to a marketing campaign, and they're already working on the next one.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, so the cycle of sort of attention is so short.
Yeah.
That, you know, there'll be people who kind of, it's like the whole analog versus digital thing. There'll be people who like cherish being contrarian culturally, but the vast majority of people are like on the subway going, and you know, even you know, they've changed the way they do movies now. You hear like the actors talk about, or the producers talk about it, where you've got to like repeat the thing because people are probably watching the movie on their phones. Or watching the movie while they're watching their phones, like that kind of stuff.
Famously, Netflix has that mandate where you have to repeat the plot points five times throughout the film so that your audience that's ironing at the time knows what's going on.
Yeah, it's just super weird. And maybe a giant opportunity as well. I'm not sure it's, I'm not sure it's like better or worse culturally. I don't know that that really matters because there's a whole bunch of bad stuff about the way it used to be. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't amazing. And like even in our careers, like it used to be you would be doing, you know, it would be pilot season and all that kind of stuff, and now it doesn't matter, and now it matters even less. But at the same time, if someone in their 20s came to me and said, what should I do, I'd be like, go make stuff, man, and put it on the internet.
But yeah, go. This is what I think YouTube, why it's not actually this earth-shattering thing. I feel like YouTube is taking over the role that film festivals used to play. And like, once COVID hit, like the in-presence film festival, I took a huge hit anecdotally. And I feel like the cultural relevance of those institutions has been declining sort of ever since.
I don't think I agree with you. I think because film festivals were still curated. This is more like...
I still think they're curated, but I think like the attendance levels are down. My feeling is that their relevance in the Hollywood ecosystem is on
the decline. Might be true. That might be true, but I don't think this takes the place. I think this is just like, it's the same with people's opinions. And what I was saying about the AI articles, like everyone can write a opinion piece because they're just trying to be noticed. Like we're doing the same thing. We're trying to be noticed. But it's so weird.
But it's exactly the curating that I'm talking about. Cause like you have this panel and they would get 1,000 submissions and they'd pick the top 30 or whatever the numbers are. And then those 30 would get visibility up the chain and give opportunities to those filmmakers. Now the filter is YouTube. You have 300 million views and you're getting exposed to Hollywood. If you're getting 50 views, you're not. So I just think it's a different filter really. And it's a more modern filter and maybe even a more real-time filter than some of
these. It's like a stock market of ideas, except I don't know that it's, I'm not sure it's completely, well, maybe it's because I haven't figured it out yet, but I don't know if it's completely fair. It's the other thing is too, is like you have to figure out a way to, I guess this is still universally true. You have to figure out a way to break the algorithm to get people to see it.
Oh, I think there's different tools and requirements to succeed on YouTube than there is in the film festival circuit, for sure. I think, you know, the more traditional films and blah, blah, blah go through the, can still succeed in that environment. All I'm saying is, like, this is a new way that Hollywood is identifying talent. I mean, they've said as much. It's not a secret. Yeah,
it's a no-risk scenario.
It probably doesn't replace film festivals, but I just feel like, kind of like as analog is on the decline. Well, actually, analog for the younger group is on the incline again because it's fashionable. But like, it's just in this moment in time, it's maybe taking on an outsized influence on Hollywood, and it's driven by the dollars.
Yeah, there's no risk if I go and make them a show for $20 or I made it for $1 million. It's a classic again, it happens with, it used to happen with music a lot. A band builds a following and then you go to the show and you go, well, they have fans. That's why even when I was younger, I used to book bands. You book the bands with the most fans as the headline because they're going to sell the tickets. And then you sneak your crappy band in the middle to get exposure. And that's kind of what you did. It's kind of the same thing. And they don't, you know, they can just swoop in and give the guy a check for $10 million, which for them is like, this is why I don't agree with the whole like, oh, YouTube versus this. It's not like this guy made a movie out of nothing. He built a whole fan base and following.
Yeah.
Then did the thing, which is like,
and that's what Hollywood is buying. It's the fan base that he's previously built, right? And I think,
You know, he's got reps. The guy's got reps. He's done this before, you know. Yeah. That's why a lot of people start in horror, because it's cheap. It's an established genre. It's genre-y. So, you know, for all the BS about, genre movies don't sell, like, well, horror does.
And horror does, yeah.
Yeah. It's got, like, a formula to it. It's fairly easy to shoot. If you've never done it before, you can kind of figure it out. And most of the people who are into it are very passionate about it. And also the audience kind of knows what to expect, basically. And then you're trying to throw in something new and unusual that makes them go, oh yeah, I remember that in that movie.
I also feel like horror is somewhat immune to social criticism. Like, you kind of know going in what you're going to get. And I feel like genres like romance, you know, almost every romance movie from the 80s and 90s, early 2000s is a man and a woman. And that, you know, now that we're in this sort of universe of non-binary love, like, does that make sense? I think people stayed away from romance for that reason. I think too, with like the sensitivity around virtually everything, comedy took a hit. So like some of the sort of pillars of low cost filmmaking, romance and comedy, kind of went on the sidelines for a bit. I think we're seeing them come back a little bit now, but horror never really took a hit.
In horror, you can just go hell bent for leather and you don't have to give a shit about anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think also too, the criticism industry has been
big time
ridiculous. Like, I went to with a group of people and I was like, you know, a bunch of nerdy guys basically. And I was like, hey, have you seen the latest Punisher thing? And I was like, oh, I heard it sucks. And I'm like, what? Wait, do you like The Punisher? Yeah. Did you like the other stuff? Yes. But you're not going to watch it because someone on the internet said it sucks? I'm like, well, that's so weird. Like, what is wrong with you?
It's become politicized too. Like,
you don't even have to pay for it. You're already paying for it.
If you like this movie, it says this about your political viewpoint. And it's just like, oh my goodness.
Well, there's that.
And so all these things become unfortunately charged with outside biases. And as you said, the critical market on YouTube in particular, you know.
I used to be really into, like, when I was a teenager in my 20s, I played in punk rock bands and all that kind of stuff. And everyone in punk rock bands is against something, right?
Yeah.
They're all against something. And you're talking to a fairly robust contrarian as well. So they're all against something. And it just became exhausting to hang out with these people. Because they're like, this, you can't do this, you can't do that. And at some point I was just like, okay, I there's certain things I'm passionate about and I don't think should be done, but like, you guys gotta relax, man. And I went through a similar thing with movies. I used to be super, sound still does bother me if it's wrong.
Yeah.
But I used to get really upset about, well, this and that and all that. And now I go into movies like, I don't care that much. Like there's movies I still like have a critical eye on them, but I try to go in looking to enjoy myself, not looking to find something to talk about that's shitty.
Yeah.
And I've seen this in The Office as well. Like everyone, you know, and actually visual effects is really bad for this.
Yeah, a lot of grumpy people.
It sucks. This industry sucks. What are you doing here then, man?
Yeah.
What are you doing? And you know, I remember talking to a few people and catching myself too. Like, you just get negative and you're like, this, I'm working hard.
I remember when I first got into the industry, some of the long beers were just so crappy. I'm like, what are you upset about? You're making movies. And then, you know, lo and behold, years later, I'm grumpy too.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely room for friction.
Sure.
But at some point you got to kind of say, you know, well, am I part of the problem?
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, so I remember talking to a friend of mine and we were both kind of like, oh man, this. And I was like, no, I don't want to complain anymore. We're supposed to be, especially in man, we're supposed to be one solving this problem. Even if it sucks, I don't want to complain about it anymore. Yeah. And the person on the other end of that was taken aback because I kind of like just like snapped out. Snapped. Of it. Yeah. I didn't snap, but I snapped out of it. I was like, this, right. I started to recognize the pattern. And they were like, oh, and then came back to me later and said, you know what? You're absolutely right. And it just made our days better, even though they had the same problems. This is what we were talking about before. Same problem, different mentality.
And that's you getting back to our sort of this sort of quasi leadership stuff that we're talking about. But like, that is such a endemic problem in VFX where this blame the client mentality comes in. And it lets you off the hook for a lot if the client is the... So another leadership tip is like, do a reality check every now and then. Like, is the client really the problem? Like, we see the same problem on multiple shows with multiple clients. Like, is there something fundamental in the way you're doing things? Because it gives the team a pass if you give that oxygen. Sometimes you just need to shut it down.
And be it's like, an immediate
even indicator. Even if you know the client is an asshole, giving it oxygen doesn't serve any purpose.
No, that's true. And I would say, again, having come in to fix things a lot, when someone tells me the client is the problem, right in that first couple conversations, it's an immediate indicator to me. It can still be true, but the fact that this is a client service business that we work in. And if you can't handle working with a client, then there are asshole clients. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But 9 times out of 10, that's an indication of a bad leadership mentality or a really bad way of framing the problem to the crew.
Yeah.
And when I hear it from, it's different when you hear it in a small company or you hear it in a big company. When you hear it in a big company, it's usually like someone is down the chain is using the client to indicate the problems that they're not solving to not get fired by the people that are coming to you now to help fix it. And in a small place, it's usually someone who is frustrated and can't figure out how to deal with a client and is like venting to the crew.
Yeah.
And like, I've been guilty of this as well.
Sure. I mean, everyone's been there.
Yeah. Sure. But it's like, no. So I always like to remind everyone, hey, you know, they paid us $10,000 for this shot. If you paid me $10,000 for the shot, would you want it to be perfect? Yes. That's a lot of money. You know what I mean? Or if it's 1,000 for someone in 1,000, especially these, indie kind of guys. If it's 1,000 or 10,000, 1,000 feels the same to them as the 10,000-20,000 that the big guys do. So, yeah, it's interesting when people blame the clients. I think there's a bit of a victim culture that is just like permeated culture generally. And you see it in visual effects a lot. There's a lot of like complaint, and the weird thing is the complaints to me, maybe we should do a whole podcast on this, but the complaints to me don't seem recent. You know, like you can complain about stuff that happened to you in the last 6 months or a year, but if you're complaining about stuff that happened to you 5 years ago, it's like you're just bitter and you're kind of a problem at that point. So yeah. You know,
unfortunately, there's lots to complain about right now if you have visual effects.
Oh, yeah.
Separate and apart from bad clients.
but what was interesting to me, and I think again it goes back to this whole like I need to express my opinion all the time. Mm-hmm. At the peak of visual effects, there was, I think, the most complaining. When
yeah, probably true, yeah.
Yeah, when artists had the most power.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird to me. Like, I get it. I worked when artists didn't have enough power, and you just, like, I mean, you needed to keep your job if you wanted to get the credit. I've had to do that kind of thing. But when you can literally just walk out the door and go to the next place, why are you...
But I think that's actually was a contributing factor, because if you came out at the right time, you were picked up out of school, if you had any kind of talent, you were given a pretty decent wage to start your career, you're exposed to the big work right away, and it kind of created this rock star mentality that
and a
sort of sense of entitlement almost, like,
we've
talked about this before, like,
yeah.
You went through the ups and downs in the early part of your career when it was feast or famine in Toronto, and now it's you know, those people never experienced the feast.
Not who I'm talking about. So I understand what you're saying. There's kind of a whiny kind of that kind of thing. Like, life's hard. There's that. But then there's the people feeding that who have been in the industry 10 more years than that.
Yeah.
That are still bitter about it. And they're like pumping it up. And they're essentially, I think this is the loop. You get the people who have not experienced the ups and downs, who maybe are feeling a bit entitled and or whatever. And then you've got people above them telling them this is shit.
Yeah.
When it's like, no, this is great.
I think too, like, there's, look, VFX is its own separate market. And so, you know, we look at salaries based on other comparables within the market. But now that, like, you know, I've had the chance to look at jobs outside of visual effects, I'm like, holy crap, there's a premium paid for that expertise in visual effects. Like,
that's what I'm saying. You know, there's like, no,
you could be a coordinator making 90K, and you look at some of like entry level exec jobs are 90K. So it's like, you know,
yeah,
there is a benefit to being in VFX, because you if you got a job, you were actually getting paid as compared to the average, probably a lot better.
That's why I don't understand. So yeah, so if you worked in, you know, London in the peak and you didn't get paid overtime and all that kind of stuff, like, I don't know what to say, then you could have moved here. And there was, this is the thing, it's like an old story. There was a certain amount of, like, you got to put in the hours to do all that stuff and whatever. But lately, what I've experienced is when people complain about that, it's not real. Because when you go to investigate, oh, you did extra hours? Okay, well, if you let me know, I would have approved the overtime. Well, I didn't really. So what are you complaining about then? So, like, often when I like probe further, there was no actual issue. It was just like a venting thing. Like, maybe it's like a compensation for not being able to vent in the office. They need to like be showier.
Yeah, maybe.
But there's a certain, I think there's a certain like age of malcontents. They're kind of closer to our age, honestly.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
And it's like, they're still bitter about it, and you know, fair enough. But like, what are you wasting your energy on it for? Like, if you're still in the industry, do the job. And if you're not, then why?
That's all tied together to the compensation bit. Like, maybe they have looked around and like, wow, I'm never going to make what I'm making now anywhere else. So maybe they're past their point of enjoyment in the industry, but
you would think that would make you kind of like reconsider your stat. Oh, well, this isn't as bad as I thought. I think it's I don't know. I don't know what the deal is with it, but it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Cause I'm like, you know, I know I got paid well and I was very high stress for me, I'm like at the top, often at the top of that pyramid of stress. Like, I am the one responsible for it, or close to one, two.
I literally felt that they were paying me for my gray hair and my fucking
wrinkles. Yeah. Exactly.
And we always joke about, you know, we're not saving lives, but often feels like it. And there is this weird endemic stress.
There is in the Hollywood stuff. Yeah, in the Hollywood stuff, there is a certain amount of like flex. Like, there's a certain amount of like, I have money, you need to do this, punk. There's a hierarchical thing going on there. That's true in most creative things. But I don't really understand the timing. Like, I understand some of the complaints, but I don't understand the timing of the complaints. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like this is why nothing's happened. Like, you could have said to me, we need unions to protect ourselves like 10 years ago. But when people were talking with the most, I'm like, what are you guys doing? You've literally gone through the peak 5 years where I'd have to pay you whatever you ask me.
Yeah.
And you can not go to work. You can work anywhere. And no one's really doing overtime. And everyone is paying for it because everyone else is paying for it. So you might be doing hours, but you're getting paid for them. It used to be not necessarily the case in most places. Most of the places I worked, except for one, had some way to pay you, but it was pretty common not to. But that changed well before that peak. And then on top of that, it clearly was going on the downhill.
Yeah.
Peak was over. And now you basically, if you're going to do that, you lost your power.
Yeah, there's no leverage anymore.
What are you doing?
I remember like when I was in one of the companies I was at, there was a fledgling union movement. And this was big in Quebec for a while. And they it's funny because they got me on an interview for CBC to talk about the tax credit change. And then they sprung this union question on me. My answer then is that my answer now, it's like the studio, by and large, the vendors are not the problem. It's the studio pressure. Like, it's not like Cinesite or DNAG or any of these companies are making, well, maybe DNAG is making money head over fist, that there's these huge margins that are being kept out of the hands of the workers. At least I can speak somewhat knowledgeably about Cinesite. And it was a myth, but the work conditions and all those things are driven by the market. So what we actually need is like a trade organization where like the studios get together at the vendor level and say, okay, here's the band we're going to pay for with floors for certain shots. Here's the kind of hours we're going to get our employees to work. And apparently there was a huge effort in the 90s to get that done. But the companies that could compete on volume, who had Indian outsourced vendors like DNAG and MPC, nixed it because they were competing on price. So as a result, we had no guidelines. And it was this now bidding to the bottom, which suits Hollywood just fine. But unfortunately, so you see all these, you know, speaking of complaining, like Reddit, the fucking epicenter of complaining. Oh, you know, they need to bid more for these shots. Well, you know, guess what? If they bid more for these shots, you're not getting the work. So, yeah,
that's hilarious to me. That might be a good future podcast episode of just talking about the reality of bidding. Because I think a lot of people, it's like being in parliament and being on the opposition side. It's easy to be in opposition. It's hard to be in government. And I've worked with many, many new people who have to bid all of a sudden after talking a lot of shit. And they are usually just as bad or worse at the beginning because it's not an easy thing to gauge. And, you know, it's not that it's not true. I think when I was thinking about, maybe we can end it here. I was thinking about what you're saying, that is maybe I should be more empathetic because I think the complaints, they sound specific, but I don't think they are. I think it's like a feeling of powerlessness.
And I think that's what it is for sure. Yeah.
It's a big problem in Western society at the moment. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't feel like I have any control. Like, I have to, now as I'm thinking about it, I'm sympathizing. Like, I can't control where I live. Well, mm-hmm. I could move, but so we just decided that Toronto isn't as busy. Whereas this other jurisdiction is going to be busier, and that's worked for Toronto on the other hand. So it's not like it's not happened the other way, but yeah, if you're trying to lead your life, I think you could go down a pretty bitter path feeling like you have no control. And I don't know, maybe
should definitely do an episode on mental health, because like there are some strategies, like turning off your news feed, for example, because there's never anything good there. Just to like,
maybe,
you know, speaking of powerlessness, if you've got your eye on the news anywhere in the world right now, it's just all terrible. And like, as an individual contributor, there's not a whole lot you can do about it, unfortunately.
No. And so it's another reason to, like, that's one of the reasons why I don't want to make that one about the finance stuff, is because I feel like many in the industry have not really realized that they're getting paid well. You know, there's always, everything's relative. You feel like, okay, well, you know, I'm getting paid this and I should be getting, this guy's getting paid that. But then if you like, when you're out of the industry and you start to look around, you're like, oh, wow. Okay, we were getting paid generally pretty well. And at least in North America. And the question is sort of like, what did you do with it? And did you set yourself up to sort of reduce the stress and anxiety of not being in control? I think that's also a useful strategy for the world at the moment, too. It's like, okay, well, if you can get your own shit together, then these other problems are, you're not as susceptible to them, maybe, hopefully. You know, that's why, you know, even in investing, you diversify, because it just reduces the risk of these things screwing up your life and your plan. So some on that note too, we started this thinking we were going to do like one a month, and we've done one a week, and we were a little late today. And yeah, so what's interesting is people have been responding to different things. So if you have an idea of like what you want to know from us more, like for ideas for topics, some people have responded well to the sort of personal kind of stuff, which makes sense. Others have commented that they like the sort of peeling back the layers, especially I think the artists who maybe don't see all the business side of things. And you know, if you work with me and ask me a question, I'll tell you what I'm doing, because I'm just that type of person. But others are maybe more careful with that kind of stuff. But so if there's anything that you want to hear about or see us talk about, then please let us know in the comments and we'll see what we can do, as long as it's not gigantic.
Yeah, and I think from like our standpoint too, like we don't want to come on every day and bitch about, speaking of complaining, we don't want to complain about AI every freaking day. You could do, you know, it's a huge focus of the industry right now. We started this to talk about life and visual effects, but some of the stuff that's been resonating is kind of more broad, like how we in our midlife are pivoting in a career or making adjustments. Like, if that's the stuff at a more generic level that isn't so VFX specific, like also let us know, because, you know, we have perhaps more to talk about on those fronts even than we do in VFX.
Yeah, we can both talk pretty well if you just give us a prompt.
As you can tell. We said we were going to do 30 minutes, and like every time it's like an hour plus. No. So, you know, we love to talk.
Oh, well. Anyways, okay. Well, on that note, another episode of the VFX Essential Crisis Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Like, subscribe, build us up to hundreds of views and hundreds of subscribers.
Yes.
To validate this little journey that we're on. Thank you very much. See you around.
Bye for now.